Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with novelist Joseph Boyden, whose new book is The Orinda. We claim him as a New Orleans novelist, of course, but his novels are all about his native Canada. We'll also hear from Gwen Florio, whose new novel is Dakota. Her first book, Montana, won the Diana Pinkley Prize for Crime Fiction debut novel. Novelist Joseph Boyden is one of my favorite New Orleans writers. Author of Born with a Tooth, 3 Day Road, which won the Amazon Canada First Book Award along with many others, Through Black Spruce, which won the prestigious Scotiabank Giller Prize, again with many other honors, and now his most recent, The Orinda. The Orinda was a selection after a heated debate for the Canada Reads Program. Joseph's on the faculty of the University of British Columbia and the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, and he's a graduate and former faculty member of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Program. He lives both here and in Northern Ontario. And if that doesn't make you wonder how you get it all done, I don't know what will. Joseph, I am so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
It's great to see you again, Susan.
Now, The Orinda is such a moving and beautiful book. And it's a book with a poetic and mysterious title. Tell us what that means.
The Orinda is, it's an Iroquoian word and also a Huron word. It basically means the soul or the life force in a being. Very similar in some ways to the Christian idea of a soul, except that the Iroquois and the Huron believed, and still do to this day, that not just humans have a soul or an Orinda, but everything does. A body of water has its own Orinda, mm-hmm. tree, a rock strewn on the ground even has its own Orinda, its own life force, its own spirit. And so this is kind of the spiritual view of the world for what in Canada we call the First Nations people.
And I think it's something that's going to appeal to a lot of New Orleanians, too.
I think a lot
of people have that feeling about
absolutely.
This place, these things. This is the book that you have said you were destined to write, the story of a Jesuit missionary named Christophe, a Huron leader named Bird, that's a name we've heard before in your fiction, and a young captive girl called Snowfalls, adopted by Bird into his own family. And through these three, you've traced some of the most important events in Canadian history.
It's North American history, really. It spans the border between New York and Ontario, what is present-day New York and Ontario. This novel takes place in the mid-1600s, so I go way back in history to kind of some of the birth stories of our continent in terms of the Western perspective.
And what was that like for you? Because some of this has that feel of mythology and folklore and the kind of ancient poetry that comes with those forms.
Well, it was amazing in some ways because it's very freeing to be able to go back to a time period before there was a United States, before there was a Canada, when there were many, many nations already, not just surviving on this continent, but existing in amazing and complex ways. These were cultures, North America was covered in cultures that were as complex as any culture in the world at the time. So it was really fascinating for me to go back into these very specific ones of the Iroquois, they call themselves the Haudenosaunee people, and the Huron people who called themselves the Wendat people, and looking at these two societies, and then the intruder, the outsider, the European coming in to kind of throw this very fine balance off. And, Christophe the Jesuit doesn't come with bad intent in his heart, but he certainly messes things up upon his arrival mm-hmm. in all kinds of ways.
Now, this is a very violent history as well, and you've taken some hits for writing some very violent scenes in this book.
Yeah, this is a time of war. The Europeans came over, the French came over and made alliances with the Huron. The Dutch and the English came over and made alliances with the Iroquois, and old rivalries between the Iroquois and the Huron really heated up, and suddenly there's a war of attrition going on very quickly. And, it's also the first arms race in North America with the introduction of the rifle, of the musket.
The Shining Wood.
Yeah. And this is a violent novel. And I've taken a few hits, but, my wife Amanda, who you know, she drives her crazy. She's like, there's more violence in one episode of Game of Thrones than in your whole novel.
I know. It's
like,
so
why are
true.
People like, I guess I did my job, you know, the Iroquois and the Huron did the practice of torture amongst one another. And it wasn't an everyday occurrence, but when it did happen, it was a very tough thing. But, you know, there's only maybe 20 pages of torture in this novel, but it does seem to be something that a lot of people have kind of focused upon. I think it's that threat of violence during a time of war. There's always that constant threat of looming violence that kind of permeates much of this novel. And I think that has its effect on the reader.
And war has always been such an important part of your writing. War of all different sorts, cultures, yeah. you know, as well as nations. Yeah. And when you go back this far, I think you're going back to a time when war was face-to-face.
Absolutely. Yeah, this was a very personal type of warfare that existed at the time. And, you know, the idea of torture was the hardest thing for me to wrap my head around in terms of writing this novel, this idea of why would one group of people torture each other. It was actually an honoring thing, you know. Keep in mind, too, during this time period, the mid-1600s, the Spanish Inquisition was going on full tilt. And so this idea of torture of other humans was this kind of world pandemic, you know, this epidemic going on, I feel. And so it's kind of fascinating for me to look at the very two different reasons between cultures for torture. With the West, with the Jesuits, with the Catholic Church at the time, torture was a way to demean and belittle and to punish and to say, you know, you are wrong. With the Iroquois and the Huron, it was very much the opposite. It was to honor and to say, we respect deeply who you are and we want to take that power from you for ourselves, kind of thing. So it was a very, very different approach to this idea of the treatment of humans.
And a lot of this is about what made these villages work.
Yeah.
You know, there's ritual. They're really powerful women who instruct each other in
absolutely.
The ways. And,
yeah.
you know, and then they're the war bearers. And yeah. it's all these complicated roles. And I wonder if you talk a little bit about my favorite character, who is, of course, Gosling.
Yeah, Gosling is she's an Ojibwe and Anishinaabe woman who has been taken in by the Huron people. My mother's maiden name is actually Gosling. My family, I'm a mixed blood family. I'm a family of Irish, Scottish, and Ojibwe roots. And so I really wanted to pay homage to my mother's side of things with Gosling. And she's a medicine woman who is, you know, a little bit mystical for sure, who has great power of seeing a little bit into the future and of being the one who warns, you know, be careful with this crow. They called the Jesuits crows. Be careful taking this crow into your community because at first he might just seem harmless and funny and yeah. entertainment, but there's something very mysterious about him that can cause us great harm. You know, this is a time period in the mid-1600s where the Huron people, probably a population of about 35,000, and around the southern shores of what's called Georgian Bay today, a beautiful part of Ontario. But within 10 years of the first Jesuits arriving, the population was slaughtered down to 10,000 through disease, yeah, that the Jesuits brought unwittingly into these communities. And just there was no defense for it in these. You know, that's 3 in 4 people. Think about it. You have a yeah. family of 4, suddenly you're left alone kind of thing. And so this was a sadly part of the real history of the time period. So, you know, this goes back to the idea of violence, too. It's an unwitting violence, but it's violence nonetheless.
Mm-hmm. What I loved about Gosling, though, I have to say, is it's just that notion that even then there were women who lived lives on their own terms.
Oh, absolutely.
Completely.
Well, these are matriarchal societies, the Iroquois and the Huron, where the woman was the power broker. The woman was the head of the community. The men never really felt themselves and manly until they were off in the forest going off on trading expeditions or hunting expeditions. But while at home, the women were the ones you listened to. And I have 7 older sisters, and so I know exactly that feeling. You know.
Pay your respects. Yeah. Pay your respects. Now, this is not only an historical novel and a political novel, but it is really a prolonged spiritual meditation. What did writing that do for you? I mean, I can imagine reading this book, what it took out of you to write it. But what did it give you?
Well, I've said in the past, this book is kind of a part of my DNA. I was, you know, being from a family where we lived in the city, we lived in Toronto growing up, and I went to a Jesuit high school, was educated by Jesuits. And I always saw that one side. The Jesuits came to the New World, and, you know, the heathens were around the fire waiting for civilization to save them kind of storyline. And I always heard that side of the story, but then I'd look at my other side of my roots and I'd be like, we're not savages. These are incredibly complex societies. So I really wanted to capture the idea that these communities, these cultures that were already here before the Europeans came, were incredibly complex. We're living in fine balance with one another. Didn't just live, but lived very well. You know, the Iroquois and the Huron were agrarians. They were great farmers and they were rich, you know, in terms of all kinds of things, in terms of culture, in terms of food supply, in terms of religion. And with the Europeans coming, it really threw that balance off.
Now, one of the things that fascinated me was, and I don't think I've ever read this anywhere else, is that you really write about the cost of conversion.
Yeah.
What it meant to these people to give up a native religion.
Yeah. Well, you know, Orenda, I think, cuts to the heart of what I was trying to get at. This idea, you know, Christoph shows up and he's like, what is this Orenda thing they're talking about?
Yeah.
And they explain to him, well, yeah, we have a soul. And he's like, great. You know, this is my jumping off point with you. I have a soul too. I believe in the same thing. And then they go on to say, well, but this dog walking by, he has his own soul too. And that's where Christoph, the Jesuit, goes, no, wait a second. That's Satan's talk. No, this is not right. And so this kind of clash of very different views of the world makes for good fiction, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I could write about, you know, a nice, gentle, boring day where there's no war or anything else, but that doesn't necessarily make for great fiction. You know?
Where's the fun in that?
Yeah, where's the fun in that? Yeah.
Now, whenever a writer finishes a book, I mean, and this has taken you years, this is the book of your heart in so many ways, you know, you sort of go out into the world and you offer it up with varying degrees of success. And you have had that success in Canada and you have had some controversy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. This is the first time, you know, I've had it pretty lucky with my novels to date. You know, 3 Day Row and 3 Black Spruce are very well accepted in North America and in Europe, and Native people, especially across North America, really love those books. But this is the first time with the Orenda where I've got a little bit of slack from certain professors and in the Native community, certain academics saying, this is just an excuse for colonialism. And I was just gobsmacked when I started here. And there was only a very small number. There was 2 or 3 people, but these were the only negative reviews coming out of Canada and in a sea of really strong and positive reviews. But I was really kind of hurt in a way because I felt almost like I was jumped upon by a couple of people because they didn't like what they saw as the message in this novel. That was clearly not, for me, the message I was trying to send out into the world.
And not the one I received.
No,
I mean,
no, I don't. Most people don't,
yeah,
you know. But controversy is good for certain people to get names out into the world. You know, and I listened and I spoke to all of the people who, and again, there was only a handful, but it was a bit stinging. You know, the Iroquois people are known as great warriors and they're the bad guys in this novel. And so there are some Iroquois people who said, you know, you're just painting us again as the bad guy. And I was like, no, Snowfall's is Iroquois. She's a Haudenosaunee, and she's my strongest character, I believe. You know, where there's a bad guy, there's a good guy. Where there's a good guy, there's a bad guy. When you make alliances, you're going to make enemies. And so this is a novel where the Iroquois are represented as being the great warriors, but they also created the great law of peace. And this is something that I hope permeates through this novel as well. This is a novel, of course, about a time of war, but it's about family and about healing and about going on after you've lost everything. How do you go on? Whether you're Iroquois or Huron or European or, you know, so.
And about enduring friendship as
absolutely, well. Absolutely.
Absolutely. So now we're the last to get it here in the United States.
Gary Fiskejohn purposely waited. I'm glad. It's like we kind of stretched things out, you know, came out in Canada in September and then the United Kingdom in November and then France in the spring and then the United States now as well in the spring and other countries to follow. But Gary Fiskejohn, if you're into literature, you'll know he's this incredible editor. You know, he's Cormac McCarthy's editor. He's so many other amazing writers' editor. But he only does about 10 books a year. And when I got the call that he wanted to personally edit the Orenda, I was over the moon because he's a powerhouse, you know?
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
So did you do most of the writing here or did you?
I did, yeah. I wrote so much of the Orenda either at home in Mid-City or at the Fairgrinds coffee shop there by the racetrack. Every morning I was going for months and months at a time and wrote a lot of the story here in New Orleans for sure.
What does living in New Orleans give you? I would think if you were home in Canada, you walked down the street and everybody would know you.
It's getting kind of weird up there. It's funny because this Canada Reads thing, the Orenda won it and
that's
now kind of jettisoned this book into like.
And we should say, for people who don't know, that was a very public debate about what book would change a nation.
What book can change a nation, yeah. And it's 5 Canadian celebrities each choose a book and they go at it. And I don't know if one book can change a nation, you know, but It was a great honor to have this book win that competition. So.
It was great. I loved seeing all those debates on YouTube.
Yeah,
it was fascinating.
It was fascinating, yeah. Really well-spoken people and interesting debates.
We've been talking with Canadian novelist Joseph Boyden, who makes his home in New Orleans part of the time. Most of the time. Whose unforgettable new book is The Arenda. It should be at the top of your must-read list. You can meet him Tuesday, May 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Gwen Florio lives in Missoula, Montana, where she is a journalist, a novelist. She's the creator of the Lola Wicks crime novel series. Her first book, Montana, was the winner of the first Diana Pinkley Prize for debut novel, presented last month at the Tennessee Williams New Orleans Literary Festival. The second in the series, Dakota, was recently published. Gwen Florio, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you so much.
Now, you've been a reporter, and you've covered some major national and international stories, haven't you?
Yes, I've been really fortunate that way. Fortunate might not be the right word, but I have been in a number of those.
And some of them have been rather grim, like the Columbine shooting, the Oklahoma City bombings.
They were horrible. Mm-hmm. And one thing I took away from that is not so much the actual event itself, but the weight of sorrow that descends upon a community, upon the survivors, the families. I have been struck by that in every single one of these, and just the lingering aftermath. And that's what I think I try to get at in my novels, is that they're murder mysteries, you know, but a murder has these ripple effects that go far beyond the initial event.
And also not just the ripple effects of the crime itself, but the causes. I mean, you've reported from Iraq and Somalia and Afghanistan, and you have this eye for cultural diversity and currents of social change, too. Don't you think that came from being a reporter for so long?
Absolutely. You know, one of my jobs as a reporter was to go into a place that was foreign, obviously, literally in those cases, but even when you're talking about the United States, places that were far from the newspaper where I worked, and explain to people what those places looked like, what they felt like, you know, the smells that were there, just sort of to bring home that atmosphere to people so they could feel like they were actually there. And that really translates into fiction.
And then you have to win people over with your protagonist, especially if you're writing a series. You have to make them someone the reader wants to follow from book to book. So tell us about making up Lola Wicks. I love her name.
Thank you. Lola is a bit of a tough character. The very first scene, or one of the first scenes in Montana, the first book, has her basically throwing a bit of a fit in her editor's office when she finds out she's being downsized from a foreign correspondency. And she was so irascible in that scene that I just decided to continue with that aspect of her personality. And as I said, she can be tough. She kind of bowls her way into places and stomps around and is very impatient. And what I really enjoy doing to her is putting her in situations where she's got to soften up and just give her a little bit of evolution that way.
Well, I love that she acts out on behalf of every print journalist in the world, you know.
Yeah. One of the things that was fun about that was, I don't know if it was fun, but the book actually got rejected by one major publisher because he said it was too negative about journalism. It was too bitter, I think was the word. And I thought, oh, you have not begun to see bitter.
So true. Now, where Montana was a novel about female loyalty and friendship, and Lola was avenging the death of a close friend, getting to the bottom of that, in Dakota, those women's issues have a different slant, don't they?
Sure. And I think in that book, it's more about family and about women looking out for one another. you know, society lets women down in so many ways. Law enforcement lets women down in a lot of ways, the justice system in general. And they've got to find a way to cope with that. And one of the, again, most fun parts to write was how these women figured out how to stick together, how to resolve their issues, and how to start healing from some of the things that happened to them.
And in Dakota, there's a lot of female betrayal as well.
Sure, yeah. And that's something that I think happens in real life. Sometimes I think women are their own worst enemies, and I didn't want to gloss over that. So I had a lot of fun writing one of the villains.
Villains should always be fun to write, don't
yeah,
you think?
Yeah.
Now, this is a novel that draws on some of the problems that are current in your part of the country.
It really is, and I'm struck every so often. I feel like every couple of weeks I read stories in a major publication like the New York Times or see something on CNN about some of the problems in the oil fields that could have been taken directly from my book. In fact, here at the University of Montana last week, they had a 3-day conference on human trafficking, part of which focused on the oil fields. And again, I thought, my goodness, that's my book.
Right, because this is a real and terrible close-up look at human trafficking within our own country.
It is, and it is so disturbing, and I wish the conference actually had been held a year ago when I was writing the book. I just didn't realize the extent to which this is prevalent. I knew, obviously, it was happening in connection with the oil fields. And one of the most disturbing aspects is that Native women and girls are being particularly targeted because they are such a vulnerable population. You know, I wish that part about the book were fiction, and it's not.
Ah, so sad. Well, on a happier note, so tell us about your first trip to New Orleans.
Oh, it was so wonderful. I can't even begin to say how wonderful it was. You know, I had high expectations, and it exceeded them. I'm a foodie. And where better to go? And I wish I could remember the name of the gentleman. Our very first night in town, Stephanie Grace from The Advocate, a longtime friend, picked us up, took us to dinner, and who comes in within a few minutes but the food writer for The Advocate, who instantly gave us a handful of places to go.
And oh, so Ian McNulty. Like,
yes. We had this wonderful insider's guide, you know, of where to go while we were there for our very brief stay, and it was terrific.
I know. Just ask and you shall receive when you're here.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one of the funnier things when I was preparing to come, I kept asking people who'd been there, where should I go to hear music? And what I didn't realize is the answer to that was everywhere and
right.
Anywhere. It's just all around.
And you were here. You were part of the Tennessee Williams Festival, and you received the first Diana Pinkley Prize for debut crime novel. What did that mean to you?
Oh, it was the most tremendous validation. I couldn't believe it. You know, I had been writing fiction now for about 20 years, and, you know, after 20 years of rejection, you start to wonder. And during that time, I would get short stories published, and I was getting more and more of those published. I wrote a couple of novels that were not published. And this particular novel, I really had a good feeling about it. My agent was very strongly supportive, but it got turned down by every major publisher, and finally a small press picked it up. So to get that kind of validation, again, is just a terrific thing. It lets you know that you're not crazy. You know, you are on the right path. And since then, as I think you know, it's been named a finalist for an International Thriller Award, which, again, is just a wonderful thing.
Oh, that's so great. So you've gone from Montana to Dakota. So what's next?
Ah, Wyoming.
I knew it.
Working on the final draft of Wyoming. I'm kind of widening my circles in the neighborhood.
Oh, that's great. Well, I can't wait to see what Lola does next. She's one of my favorite characters.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Gwen Florio, who's the author of Montana and Dakota, and the winner of the first Diana Pinkley Prize in crime fiction for debut novel. Thank you so much, Gwen.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kara Hoffman signs Be Safe, I Love You, Tuesday, May 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. Bill Lofelm signs The Devil in Her Way, Tuesday, May 6th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Poet, painter, and book artist Afton Wilkie, author of Clarity Speaks of a Crystal Sea, is the featured reader at 1718 Reading Series, sponsored by Tulane, Loyola, and University of New Orleans students. That's Tuesday, May 6th at 7 at the Collins Hotel. The Friends of the Jefferson Public Library hold a general meeting Wednesday, May 7th at 1 at the East Bank Regional Library for presentation of the budget and the election of officers. And in the good news department, the Friends of the Jefferson Parish Library book sale was a tremendous success, and the libraries will benefit. At that meeting, the Friends will present Library Director Marilyn Hattigan with a check for $100,000, the proceeds from the sale of books over the past year and from the gift shop at East Bank Regional Library. Florida Lit's Reading Between the Wines series takes place Wednesday, May 7th at 6:30 at Pearl Wine Company in the American Can Building. This month focuses on music, with featured readers Matt Sacchini, author of Roll With It, Brass Bands on the Streets of New Orleans, Sally Newhart, author of the original Tuxedo Brass Band, and Joel Dinnerstein, author of American Cool. Kim Sune signs A Mouthful of Stars, a constellation of favorite recipes from my world travels, at a cocktail reception at Ancora Restaurant. That's Thursday, May 8th from 4:30 to 6. It's free, but please RSVP through Garden District Bookshop's website. Jeff Kinney, creator of the Diary of a Wimpy Kid series, Dave Pilkey, creator of Captain Underpants, John Cheska, author of The Stinky Cheese Man, and illustrator Dan Senta, discuss and sign their books Friday, May 9th at 6 at Metairie Park Country Day School. This is a ticketed event. You must purchase tickets at Octavia Books in advance. Corbin Addison signs A Garden of Burning Sand Friday, May 9th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Megan McDonald signs her Judy Moody books Saturday, May 10th at 10 at Octavia Books. Marsha Goldman signs Lola Goes to Work, and Marissa Moss signs Blood Diaries, Saturday, May 10th at 2 at Octavia Books. The Women's National Book Association of New Orleans meets Monday, May 12th at 6:30 at the Rosa Keller Library to hear about this year's One Book, One New Orleans selection. New members are welcome. New adult authors Cora Carmack, Jay Crownover, Sophie Jordan, Nicole Chase, Jay Lynn, and Lydia Jordan sign their books Tuesday, May 13th at 1:30 at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Joseph Boyden, signs The Orinda, Tuesday, May 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Rita Sepetti signs Out of the Easy, Sunday, May 11th at 1:30 at Octavia Books. Paula Freeman signs My Basmati Bat Mitzvah, Monday, May 12th at 5:30 at Octavia Books. And Garrison Keeler signs The Keeler Reader, Tuesday, May 13th at 7:30 at La Petite Theater, 616 St. Peter. This is a ticketed event, and tickets may be purchased at Octavia Books. The International Reading Association meets here May 10th through 12th at the Montreal Convention Center. Watch for lots of great author signings around town. Also, if you're interested in attending, day passes are available. Check out iraconference.org. Saints and Sinners, the literary festival for LGBT writers and friends, will be held at the Hotel Monteleone May 13th through 18th. There's a great roster of speakers, including Carol Anshaw, Greg Herron, Andrew Holleran, and Edmund White. For information, check out sasfest.org. Romantic Times is holding its annual conference here as well, May 14th through 18th at the Marriott on Canal Street. Watch for hundreds of romance writers, including E.L. James of 50 Shades of Grey fame. Check out rtconvention.com for more information. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.